the winner of this bout, and new world heavyweight champion. Wrestling with History on the VOC Nation Wrestling Network. That's right, the newly minted VOC Nation Wrestling Network. We're dropping radio, but this is Wrestling with History. The voice of choice, Bruce Ward, the least person that you want to see, but I'm alongside the two superstars, Killer Ken Resnick and the legend maker, Wonderful Willie, Bill Apter, for another round of Wrestling with History. Not just new network name for VOC Nation. We're tweaking the format a little bit this week as we do a spotlight episode on the one and only Vincent Kennedy McMahon.
Wait a minute. We got this just huge news yesterday, and you don't even include the term worldwide. I don't understand.
Yes.
Thank you, Ken.
Bruce, do I need to try and go like channel Mr. Fuji and send you mind-to-mind communication?
Like, what's up with this guy? What's up with that?
I'm trying to talk as little as possible. They don't want to hear. People are making it very clear. As this show grows in numbers and in popularity, the feedback is very consistent. They don't want to hear from me. They just want me to open the show and turn it over to you. So I can't even tell them that we're number one in China. I can't tell them that because I'm not allowed to talk.
We're number one in China, Bill, and he drops the term worldwide. Go figure.
I know, which is absolutely incredible. Right. I think we're going to have to riot here and just take over the ship. So how have you been, Ken?
Pretty good. After a week of sub-zero temperatures, it's actually above freezing today. The sun came out.
So that's good. But you know what? You know what? We are here to discuss one person, backstage stories of one guy who, if he had the voice of choice, Bruce Wirt, right now, he would say two words to him. And you know what that would be? You're fired.
Yes. Yes. He absolutely would. Before we get to Vince, we are worldwide at vocnation.com. That won't change. We will be going through an overhaul of the website, so stay tuned for that. This show is available in full form on audio on all of the podcast apps, so radio.com, iHeartRadio, iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play. And then on YouTube, we pick little snippets and we upload them to YouTube. The full video podcast will be available for a very low price starting in a few weeks on our Patreon. More information to come. But Bill and Ken.
And that's right. You can watch the number one wrestling podcast in all of China.
In all of China.
By the way, I want to mention that there's a gentleman who runs a show in China. And Bruce, I don't know if you have the information in front of you that I sent you earlier today, because my my Facebook is not available to me right now, but there's a gentleman who runs a show for a sit-down interview show that's based in China, and it's all about pro wrestling. His first name is Al Lung.
Al
Lung. And we want to send a shout out to Al Lung that in China.
Chinese wrestling.
Yeah, the VOC Nation. The entire umbrella of shows under the VOC Nation is number one in wrestling podcasts in China. And I mean, we are above Stone Cold Steve Austin's son. We're above Chris Jericho. I mean,
all of the Conrad shows. All of the Conrad shows.
Wow. Unbelievable.
Now listen, for those of you who are educated about this stuff, Apple will update their charts every 12 hours at 1 o'clock. So 1 p.m., 1 a.m. And it varies. So you go up and down, but I've seen us number one, like four different times in the last couple of days, and then we'll dip a little bit and then we'll go back up. So Very exciting. And we keep climbing on the U.S. charts, too. We've cracked the top 50 many times over the last couple of weeks, which is it's hard to do. There's a lot of great shows out there and a lot of great talent.
Yeah. You know, I know we have to get to Mr. Vincent Kennedy McMahon, but Bill, are we doing something wrong where we are number one in China but barely cracked the top 50 in our own backyard?
Well, I don't believe that. I think
too much voice of choice.
I think technically, the issue is not an issue. We're growing consistently.
That's true.
Unquestionably.
The VOC Nation Wrestling Network, not just this show, lots of great content. Go to vocnation.com. You can see all of it. And remember, more information coming on the Patreon, where we'll have full video episodes and then some more exclusive content. So we'll get you that information as it develops in the next couple of weeks. We're going to start talking right now about the one and only Vincent Kennedy McMahon. And remember, VOC Nation, our shows take you behind the scenes of the greatest moments in pro wrestling history. So we're not just going to give you a biopic of Vince McMahon. We're going to give you behind the scenes stories of Vince
McMahon. Backstage stuff.
Born August the 24th, 1945. That's right. He's 75 years old from Pinehurst, North Carolina, Bill. And Vince McMahon is obviously the son of his father, Vincent J. McMahon.
People that are the sons of their fathers.
But he was, they were introduced at the age of 12. So Vince didn't grow up necessarily with his father. And do you have any story there, Bill? Do you have you gotten any stories about Vince the first time that he met his father?
Well, not the first time he met his father. I do know that his father was a totally different type of person than Vince. When you talk to wrestlers about Vince Senior and Vinny, there's such a huge difference between the two of them and both their methods of business and personalities, where Vince Jr. was someone who really wanted to get out there. And as you know, very boisterous and very out there. And his dad didn't want any part of the spotlight whatsoever. Not at all. They were totally different that way. But one thing that a lot of people don't know, and there's a great book called The Capital Revolution by a guy named Tim Hornbecker for you to read. And it's all about the whole situation between Senior and Junior and the whole Capital Wrestling Corporation. Yeah. But what I didn't know until a few years ago was that Vince Senior also went about business that sometimes was a bit questionable, going into different areas and trying to, I'll use the word, take over some different territories and stuff. But I had a long relationship with Vince Senior. I started in the magazine business, as you know, in the early 70s, and Vince Senior did not care for my mentor, the publisher of the magazine, Stanley Weston. The two had a falling out several times, but Vince Senior told me when I contacted him that I seemed like an affable fellow and that he would give me a chance. And again, he was never out there at all. He was always behind the scenes. He was a businessman. He was extremely classy, always came to the garden in a tuxedo, looking just like a wealthy businessman, like he was, very, very a dapper looking man. And I do remember the early days when he would start bringing what everybody called Vinny back then into the dressing room area. And he just wanted to be one of the boys.
Yeah. Well, and I see that Vince McMahon in my research, I saw that Vince McMahon actually wanted to become a wrestler. And just like you said, Vince's father said that wrestlers or promoters don't appear on the show and they should stay apart from the actual wrestlers. So,
well, that's interesting because one of the early things that Vince Jr. told me when before he actually took over the driver's seat from his father. Anytime you would see a picture of himself in the magazines, he would give me one of these. And he wasn't being nasty. He says, listen, I would appreciate if you kept me out of the magazines. I didn't know what he was going after. And then I asked him one time why. He says, well, that's for the talent, not for me. Little did I know that in his mind, he was already structuring that, why are these, and I heard this firsthand, why are these people making a profit off of their product when they could be putting out their own magazine?
Sure. Bill, when was the first time that you met Vince Jr.? Well, he's not a junior, but Vince.
No, everybody called him Vinny or Vince Jr. Yes, right. You're absolutely correct. Probably he started coming around his father had hired him as an announcer.
He was a ring announcer for All-Star Wrestling, and 69 is when he made his debut. And people remember a lot of Vince McMahon doing the announcing, but I found it fascinating. I never knew he was a ring announcer.
He did that. His dad put him in many different, he learned the whole business. He helped with putting rings up. He helped with everything there. So I met him probably, I started in 1970. I probably met him in 73, 74, maybe. And then when he was starting to do broadcasting from the Garden and other places, sitting at ringside, being the broadcaster, I thought he was incredible. I really did. I thought he was one of the best commentators that I had ever. He had that, well, look at him, Gorilla Monsoon. Now he had that make you want to listen type of thing about him. But when I first saw him little by little starting to take over, it reminded me of a day in his office where I wasn't there. This was in the New Haven Coliseum where he had.
You were there, but not there, or you really weren't there?
I'll tell you how. I was there by telephone. And I used to call the office periodically. And the only two people in the office was Vinny Jr. and Howard Finkel. Howard was his longest employee ever. Howard stayed there till Howard passed away. Howard was with him from the start there. And I remember any time that I would call the office, Vince would say, well, how can I help you? And he was always very fast. So I figured maybe I'm bothering him. And Howard and I would talk periodically on the phone. And I remember I wanted to cover a show in Allentown. I was living in Queens at the time. And I didn't know how to get there. And I figured, what the heck? I'll call Howard. And I was in the magazine office, actually, in Rockville Center. And I called and the phone rang and Vince picked up. Hello, can I help you? I said, oh, hi, Vinny. It's Bill Apter. And I could tell right then he was starting to sound like it's not Vinny anymore. It's Vince, not Mr. McMahon, but Vince. And I said, can I speak to Howard? He said, well, what's this about? We're very busy. No, you're laughing, but this is business here. And I said, well, I'm planning to come up to Allentown, and I don't know how to get up there, and I figured maybe Howard could give me directions. I heard a long pause, and then he said, why don't you get a map? And he hung up. He hung up. It was quite scary. It's quite scary.
I'm afraid to laugh because you just told me. I know that these fans out there are not going to want me to laugh.
So I'm not telling jokes here. So Howard called me back a few days later and he says, I understand that, you called me about this and Vince was upset. We're like really busy here. He said he'd prefer that you not be at that show. I was like, what did I do? I said, was it because of the phone call? He says, no, there's some things going on internally that there's going to be a bunch of meetings at that show that night. So I didn't go. And I stopped calling the office. Howard and I would talk at night from my home to his home. Vince was out of the picture with me at that point. But it was scary because I noticed a I noticed a change in everything. And, you know, I hadn't known that he was getting ready at that point for to get the business from his father and, you know, start to take over the business. And as you know, when he did, not only did he steamroll over the territories that, of course, Ken is can speak on very easily there, but he's going to steamroll over the magazines. And I had, there was an incident where he was telling that Mr. Weston called me into the office one day. By the way, none of this is in my book. This is all exclusive. I'm going to talk about this
right here.
Yeah. On the VOC Nation.
Yes. Wrestling Network worldwide.
Yes. Worldwide, especially in China. But Mr. Weston, my boss, called me in and he says, McMahon Jr. is going around to the distributors telling them if they take our magazine and not his, that he's not going to let us have any access or anything. We were already feeling that. So I called a bunch of the, I called the distributor that we were with and he confirmed that. And I started getting calls from people like Ole Anderson, Eddie Graham. People, what do you hear about Vince? What do you hear about Vince? You think it's going to succeed? You think Junior is going to? And I would say nothing nasty. I'd say, well, the only thing I tell them was that the distributor story, which was true. So a few months later in Las Vegas, Nevada, at the National, I always say that like Tom Jones, because I saw him in Las Vegas 100 times. And here we are in Las Vegas, Nevada.
Home of the best piano bars in the entire country.
Well, they were until COVID took over.
No, that's true.
But, and I'm sitting at a table at the NWA convention with David Von Erich, his lovely wife, Trish, Vince McMahon and his wife, Juanita, who I used to talk to Vince Sr. on the phone almost every week, just a polite call. He'd call me once in a while just to, we talk about the rankings and the ratings, et cetera. And I was with, I think, George Napolitano and someone else at the table. And I went to get up to use the bathroom. And as I was getting up, Vince Sr. got up and he's following me and he grabbed a hold of my wrist in the lobby. My nose is running from my Aptor's Alley chilliness here.
Not your COVID shot, right?
No. Actually, the second COVID shot, I didn't have any reaction to. It's good. So he grabbed me like this, by my hand, and he held me there. I said, what's the matter? He said, I hear you've been saying bad things about Vinny. He said, I don't know what you've been saying, but Vinny's not going to do anything to hurt you people at all. I don't know what you have in mind, but you know, if you keep saying things about Vinny like this, you know, you're not going to be like George, you're going to be out of the fold. And I was like, wow. And later on during that meeting, Ole Anderson asked me what Vince had said. And Ole pretty much told me that he says, oh, the old man's full of crap. He knows exactly what his son's going to do. So, yeah, so those are the early things. Vince was never nasty to me in terms of personally at all. Everything he did, I took as this was business. And it was, because he would never call me up and say anything bad. He never said anything bad about me to people. He would say, I don't want those magazine people hanging around, but he never said anything bad about me. And through the years, through the ban of the magazine ban, when all the magazines were banned, when he started his own magazine, he did offer me the job as the editor several times. I turned it down because I was very loyal to Mr. Weston and Inside Wrestling, the wrestler, and eventually PWI. But we were locked out, and I'd see him in hotels once in a while where the wrestlers were staying, and he'd see me and he'd come over and he says, what are you doing here? Do you have a camera? And I said, no. I always told him that I would never embarrass he or me by doing anything like that. Anybody that sent us pictures was one of our freelancers. It was never me.
Before,
so kind of my inside backstage stories of him. I do have some more, but it's more recent stuff. And I think, you know, Ken should chime in with his relationship working for Vince McMahon.
Yeah, Ken, talk to us about that infamous first meeting. And, you know, we have it in long form in the archives, but give us the short story of your first interaction with Mr. McMahon.
Where is that Resnick guy?
When they flew me out to New York, when I got to the office, it wasn't like a normal corporation where you might, you know, if you were interviewing, you'd go to human resources. So they kind of scheduled it. You know, I met with Terry Garvin. I met with Pat Patterson. I met with George Scott. I think I met with Arnie Skolin. And I think there was kind of a hierarchy. After each meeting, they take me back out to the lobby, and then whoever I met with would talk to the next person. And I'm guessing, you know, I got, yeah, he seems like a good guy, or, you know, someone we should certainly look at, because it was like I kind of got passed up the food chain. And I think the last person I met with right before Vince was Pat Patterson, same back to the lobby. And then I got, you know, called into Vince's office, sat, you know, in front of him. He was behind his desk. And, you know, we talked for maybe 2-3 minutes. And he asked me about my mustache, you know, right away. I wasn't quite sure, you know, what he meant. And, you know, then he went on, wanted to know when I grew it, how attached I was to it, asked me a few questions, and came right out and said, you know, in spite of Oakland, I hate facial hair. And then he just stopped. He didn't say anything anymore. He just like looked at me. And I kind of said, well, I guess if you're asking if everything else worked out, would I consider, you know, shaving my mustache if it was that big a deal? Yeah, I guess I would shave it. And that was it. And then we visited and talked about, you know, a number of different things for 45 minutes to an hour, you know, maybe a little more. And then same thing, all of a sudden he just stopped, looked at me for, you know, 30 seconds to a minute, didn't say a word, opened up his top desk drawer, pulled out a razor, a can of shaving cream, pushed it across the desk and said, bathroom's right through that door. And to backtrack, during that conversation, we had talked about, you know, when I would be available, we had talked salary. So it wasn't like, you know, just did that, but that's what he did. And I went in the bathroom, shaved my mustache, came walked back out to his office. You know, he had a private bathroom. And he looked at me and he said, well, you just showed me one thing that's important to me. And, you know, I looked at him and gave him a quizzical look. And he said, you showed me when you say something, you back it up. You'll start Saturday.
Wow.
And that was it. And, you know, reflecting back and my time there, I think in some small way, it was, you know, probably everything he said about mustaches was true. But I also think, you know, I was a new employee coming from a different territory. And I think he wanted to establish that, you know, there was, like I've said, during my time, there was two rules you never broke from. Rule number one, Vince is always right. Rule number two, if you think Vince is wrong, see rule number one. I think it was Vince's way of just establishing that, hey, I'm the boss. You do what I say.
Ken, I have a question for you. I was just listening to on 83 Weeks, which is Eric Bischoff's podcast that he does with Conrad Thompson. And Conrad, I'm still upset with you. The rank behind us in China. And Conrad and I will get in the ring over the name Wrestling with History. But that's another story for another day. He is liking our show on Twitter. So
actually, to be very honest with you, I spoke with him earlier. yesterday, I sp- you're laughing. I talked with him yesterday over something, and he likes what VOC Nation is and what VOC Nation does. He was extremely complimentary. He did not know that I'm part of VOC Nation yet. And he was like, he said that Bruce is a great guy and you're with a great company. And I gave him the history of how long we've known each other. And yeah, so well, just add that in.
I've said this on the record a lot of times. The reason I'm doing this again is because Conrad ignited my passion for, I listened to the Something to Wrestle with Bruce Pritchard and I really didn't miss it for a long time, Bill. I stopped doing it for 5 years and Brady was doing everything day to day. And
Brady Hicks for you people who don't
know. And I just, I listened and I said, wow, I really miss doing that, but I don't want to do it. I don't like the current product. It has to be something that works. And, you know, I fast forward, I ended up talking to Ken. I was doing a show really by myself. My former co-host was kind of in and out and he had some family things that he had to take care of. So I called Ken and I said, hey, Ken, do you want to do this together? I'm kind of thinking about getting back into this. And that was before I got the bill for the network again. That's another story for another day. And Ken said, sure, we'll have some fun. And here we all are. But
there's revisionist history. You first texted me. I said, what? Me? No way. And I'm just not a podcast, you know. And it was like, yeah, I wasn't absolutely receptive. Bruce kind of talked me into it, you know. And I was like, well, okay, I'll give it a try.
Here we are, two years later.
Hold on. Since you brought up Bruce, there's a Vince Bruce story that I have that nobody knows about.
Well, let me ask Ken this one question. Hold that, right? We're going to do that right on the other side of the first break. But I want to ask Ken this, and shout out to Conrad. Thank you so much for doing what you do, because you do a great job. You put out a lot of great content for everybody. Adfreeshows.com. I recommend the subscription. I got the $10 package myself. So there you go. Ken, 83 weeks, Eric Bischoff tells a lot of stories about Vern Gagne. It sounded like Vern was much more conversational and would hang out with the talent, or at least people he was close with backstage, and joke around. That's at least what I got from Eric's stories. Vince versus Vern, what was the biggest difference between the two?
In comparison to Vince, you know, Eric is not wrong. Vern would be in the locker room, you know, with the boys, but a lot of times it was also because of Vern was on the show, right? You know, Vern was, you know, for a lot of the time, the champion. But I will say, you know, Vern didn't, you know, necessarily hang out, but certainly Vern was more accessible, you know, than Vince. Pretty much back then, you know, for the announcers and at least the somewhat lesser talent, the only time you interacted really with Vince is when Vince wanted to see you about something. So in terms of that, Eric's correct. You know, Vern was around more and more accessible.
Yeah, Vince
you could just walk up to Vern and say, hey, Vern. And, you know, he would.
Yeah, Vince usually sent you. Vince was in his own office. By the way, I lost the two of you for about a whole minute and a half there. So
we saw you.
Oh, was I moving or was
Yeah, you were moving. You were great.
I was talking with no words coming out. But with Vince, he has an office, and if you needed to see him, usually he'd be glad to see you after you talked to several people to get to him. With Vern, and I remember being backstage at a lot of the AWA shows, where somebody sought out Vern, sometimes he'd say, see Wally Carbo, or see Al DeRusso, or see Greg. But if he really thought it was something they needed to talk to him, he made time to do that.
But even in that case, and Bill, you're absolutely right, but you could still walk right up to Vern and say, hey, I want to talk to you about, and then Vern would say, you know what, go talk to Wally about that, or talk to Al, whereas you couldn't really just, you know, walk into Vince's office and say, hey, I want to talk to you about.
No, not. You could do that during the early days because he wasn't the Vince. He wasn't the Vince that we come to know. As the business was growing, Vince became more of a businessman, and he had to have people as his left hand and right hand men and people do, just like any company. You know, sometimes somebody will start a new company and they're very happy and very, and then as the company's making money and everything, they have to hire underlings. I hate to use that term, but who are very important to do the job of what that Vince at that company may have had to do.
And one of the most famous came on in 1987, and his name is Bruce Pritchard. And I know you got some stories, Bill. I want to sneak in a quick break. We'll come back on the other side with that setup, and you can tell us about your Vince McMahon, Bruce Pritchard story. This is Wrestling with History Worldwide.
Worldwide, especially in China.
The VOC Nation Wrestling Network.
This is Matt Hardy, and you are listening to the VOC Nation.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
510 is declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
VOC Nation provides live daily streaming shows where fans have the ability to interact with the hosts and guests by phone call, email, and Twitter. VOC Nation hosts include the legendary Ken Resnick, you probably remember from the AWA and WWE, former WCW performer The Maestro, Wes Briscoe, who you probably remember from Impact, Brady Hicks, who you remember from Pro Wrestling Illustrated, former WWE and TNA star Shelly Martinez, and former Philly radio personality Bruce Wirt. What are you waiting for? Go listen live right now at VOCNation.com and subscribe to all of our podcasts by searching for VOC Nation Radio Network on your favorite podcast app. Oh, and follow them on Twitter too, at VOC Nation.
Back here on Wrestling with History Worldwide in the VOC Nation Wrestling Network, the number one wrestling podcast in China. That's right, Chris Jericho, Conrad Thompson. We're number one in China. Bill, before the break, you mentioned that you had a story, Bruce Pritchard and Vince McMahon story that I would love to hear.
Well, wait, and hold those up again and watch your lighting. You know, I was a photographer. Hold those up again. Now, you can't see the one in your right hand because it... Oh, yeah, there's Vince.
The light. Yeah, there's Vince.
Go ahead. Let's see the other one now. I love you, brother love. Brother love.
I'm trying to get the glare from that light.
Well, that's why I'm wearing a hat, so you don't have the glare from my comb over.
There we go.
Bob, you know what? We'll put up with
gross.
Too here. Okay, so here's the story. This is before Bruce Pritchard was brother love or anyone really knew him outside of Houston. Bruce was working for Paul Bosch, the legendary promoter of Houston wrestling. And I remember getting a call one night from Bruce saying that after years of working for Paul, he's going to be giving notice soon because he got a call from Vince McMahon to come to New York. He didn't have all the Bruce Pritchard built into him at that point.
Right.
We talked for a long time and he asked me what I thought of the move. And I said, well, how are you going to tell Paul? And that was his issue, is how he was going to do it. And I never really talked to him about how he did it. And he was like a son to Paul Bosch. He really was. Paul taught him everything from booking to ring announcing to everything. So I remember when I was sitting, being offered a job in Titan Towers, J.J. Dillon had brokered me to come in to talk to Vince and Linda about possibly working for the magazine. And again, I said, well, what happens if the magazine doesn't work out, well, we'll find something for you to do. That now I have over here, and it's in my book, I believe, an actual letter from J.J. Dillon welcoming me to the WWF.
Wow, 1993.
Yeah. So, but this was not for the magazine. So the other thing that they were going to find for me to do here was that they were going to start a Hall of Fame. And they actually, this meeting was not about me with the magazine. I'm going to rewind that. This was for me to possibly be the curator of the Hall of Fame, that they were going to have a physical Hall of Fame. So my question was, what happens, you know, if this doesn't happen? We'll find something for you to do. So they put me on a retainer for a few years at $100 a week to procure stuff from wrestlers. I got Buddy Rogers boots and a bunch of other things. And I was sitting at that meeting and I had talked to Bruce, I don't know, somewhere around there. And I said, by the way, I just talked to Bruce Pritchard from Paul Bosch's office. Oh, I heard about any things I heard about him. And I wound up hiring him eventually, of course. But that's why I said it's kind of a Bruce Pritchard. Nobody, Bruce wasn't even Bruce Pritchard, as I mentioned at that point. He was a young kid trying to make his way into the business, and look where he's become. Yeah, he went from Brother Love to so many other great places in the business.
What's the saying, Bill, that people would take a bullet for Tom and put one in Bruce? Isn't that?
I never heard that. Never heard that.
Oh boy.
Bruce and Tom, it's funny that I never, even though they are brothers, I never saw them together. I never felt they were brothers.
Right.
And two different personalities, completely. Two different personalities. So, yeah.
So one of the things
I would say the opinion of the two brothers is rather different.
Yeah.
Yeah. So toward the end of the last few years, as you know, I've been on the WWE Network many times.
Yeah.
And during my times either backstage at WWE or filming them up at WWE, I've come across Vince. And instead of that, what are you doing here? He looks at me and he gives me a hug. He says, nice to see you. And the picture, one of the pictures on the cover of my book is Wrestling Fixed.
I didn't know it was broken.
Thank you. On sale everywhere. You know, I got to get one plug in. One of the pictures is Vince and I together, and that was taken, about the book is 5 years old, so maybe six or seven years ago. And once in a while, they are courteous enough to let me come backstage. There are no more cameras or anything. They don't care. They don't have a magazine anymore. But I don't bring a camera anyway. Everybody has a cell phone these days. But every time I run across him in the hallway, he always comes over and talks to me. So nice. Because he knows that I have been through the hardest part of what he did, watching the territories disappear under his going in and taking them over, and the nicer parts of what he did where he became so huge, his company, that wrestlers, performers were making more money than they ever dreamed they could have.
Sure.
Yeah. So a lot of people are going to listen to this on the VOC Wrestling Network. A lot of people are going to see this on our upcoming Patreon platform. But I don't want them to think that I was going out to bury Vince McMahon with stories, because that's not the relationship that I had with him. The relationship was a business relationship that was not good, because he wanted to put out his own wrestling magazine and it was his product and he could do what he wanted to. But on the personal end, he was always okay with me. And Linda was as well. And Stephanie, through the years, And yeah, always been, had a good relationship.
Ken, and you were there for, I think, what, 86, early 86 until, what, the beginning of 88?
87, 88.
88. And obviously, you know, you were a big part of the formative years of Primetime Wrestling and Wrestling Challenge. So you were around a lot and for some of the biggest angles in most of our lifetimes. I mean, in terms of wrestling, when at least for me, my fandom is in the 80s, and that's the stuff I remember. I don't remember, the Attitude Era was great, but I remember the little things that happened in the 80s. So I'll speak for myself. Because you were part of a lot of the action and you were doing the backstage interviews, did you have any tense moments with Vince McMahon ever? A lot of the stuff was pre-recorded, so it's not like it's live and there's big pressure. But was there any tense moments that stick out?
There was really only, you know, one. And again, for the majority of the, you know, thousands of interviews, you know, it was the agent. Vince wasn't even, you know, there. The only tense or chewing out I got was I did an interview with the British Bulldogs and they had, you know, Matilda. And, you know, we got along great. And I think, you know, they had said, hey, we're going to set Ken up.
Matilda, by the way, was a dog for the people who are watching this and don't know.
English Bulldog. And they had Matilda there and we're doing the interview. And I think it was, you know, Davey Boy started it and then, you know, Bulldog picked it up and it was talking more and more about Matilda. And, you know, Matilda's been neutered. So, you know, we don't have to worry. She's never going to have any puppies. And Davey said, well, now what do you call a dog that's been neutered? What's that word? And they're going back and forth. Well, Ken, you're smart. You must know. What do you call a dog that's neutered? I mean, you know, Matilda. And they were saying, yeah. And then I finally said, well, you call a dog that's been neutered is. She's not gonna be able to have any puppies, and it shows you the difference between back then and now. And it was, you know, it aired on TV. I mean, everyone in the room didn't have a problem with it, but the following week, I'm doing interviews and kind of take a break. And then I forget who comes up and somebody says, Vince wants to see you.
Oh.
And I'm kind of, I had no idea, but as I'm walking to, you know, Vince's office at whatever arena we were in, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm going, I'm not sure what it is, but this is probably not going to be good. And, you know, I go in and Vince references that interview and he goes, don't ever do that again. And then that was it. You know, he didn't like the fact, you know, I said. On the air,
Jesus,
set up.
Ken, by, now I got to bleep it twice.
By the Bulldogs. And I was smart enough in the instant I thought about saying, well, they really set me up, but I'm thinking this is Vince and that rule number one. And I said, you're right. I absolutely apologize. It'll never happen again. So that was in all the time, the only really tense moment I had with, Vince. The only other thing, one day, you know, I was doing interviews and Vince came in the room for a while, didn't say anything. And we took a little break and Vince just comes up to me and he says, hey, do the rest without your shoes. Your heel is making you too tall, you know? So, and then from that point on, you know, I just took my shoes off. So I was a little shorter, you know,
that was very sensitive about that in the old days.
But you know, that wasn't a tense moment or anything. He just said, you know, hey, you know what? Take your shoes off. You'll be a little shorter.
There were a lot of times when I used to go to the TV tapings in Allentown.
Ag Hall, brother.
Huh?
I said, okay. Ag Hall, brother.
Get a map. When I go to the to the TV tapings, and Vince would be interviewing someone who's practically a wrestler who was almost eye to eye with him, and they would call for a milk crate or something and have the guy stand. So I want to back up on something where I told you earlier in an earlier segment about Vince asking me not to put him in the magazines, that the talent is for the boys.
This is Vince Sr.
Junior.
Oh, Junior. Okay.
Okay. Vince Sr. Didn't mind periodically when I took a picture of him.
Got it.
Not at all. Vince Jr. was the one who said to me, don't put me in the mag, because he was going to formulate his own magazine. So we're at WrestleMania press conference number one that I was not invited to, but I was told, go. They can't keep you out of there. It's a public press conference, not for fans, but press. And I went. I think we talked about this on a prior show.
WrestleMania show.
Look, so I saw Vince McMahon with a WrestleMania backdrop behind him. The Undertaker was standing here. Basil DeVito, who was Vince's right-hand man at that time, was standing there. And there were photographers coming up, taking pictures of him. And I stood in line, and it was my turn, and Vince's eyes hit my eyes. And instead of what he could have done, what's like, why are you doing this? Because there were a lot of press there. I'd never seen almost a shy blush out of him in my life. And he just kind of did like, hi, Bill. And he let me take the picture. And that's in my book, by the way. Is wrestling fixed?
I didn't know it was broken.
On sale right now. No, but that's true. It's a true story. So I got him to take a photo of him. And then I was invited to a couple of WrestleMania press conferences through the years. And, there was press there, and I clicked away with everybody else. There was never any, well, we don't want Bill to do this.
Interesting.
I think he realized after a while, even though they had their own magazine, when they had things like WrestleMania, that the quote-unquote legit press was covering, that it would be wrong to toss out the wrestling press.
I think there's so much that we can talk about with Vince McMahon. We'll probably end up doing another show at some point.
I don't want to talk about it anymore. That's it. I'm done.
To cover more. But before we get out of here, I got to ask you guys. And by the way, when I poke at Bill a little bit, Bill and I have been friends for over 10 years now.
10 years, 3 months, 6 days, and 12 hours.
Don't think I'm being disrespectful to the legendary Bill Apter or the legend maker Bill Apter or the legendary Ken Resnick.
Hold on. Yes, Vince. Yeah, no, it's done. No, I said nice things about you. Thank you. Bye. I'm sorry.
We have a very friendly relationship, and they would give me a really hard time if I ever stepped out of line, and we'd probably delete it from the show. So please.
Well, I'm going to be honest with you, because this has happened to me when I was doing a podcast with one of my adopted nephews, Josh Chernoff, and he's got a sarcastic sense of humor, and he used it on me a few times, and he got lambasted by my after chatters. He really did. So anyone that interviews me, you have to understand that the after chatters, who I love so much for supporting me through the years, through the magazine days and after the magazine days and during the current magazine day of looking for the magazine, I don't have it here, Inside the Ropes magazine, they support me, and they're my backbone. They're always with me. But I know you don't mean anything really.
It's funny. There's nothing. I've been attacked for poking at you. And anytime I've ever said anything about Dave Meltzer, they come out in force. Meltzer's got his army.
Yeah.
Don't talk about Japanese wrestling. Hey, so before we get out of here, Vince McMahon changed the product. So wrestling was geared towards, I would say, adults, and it was hardcore and blood and guts a lot in the 70s and 60s. And Vince McMahon came along in the 80s and said, and this is probably a lot of why Ken got in trouble for using that word, which I'm not going to say because I'll have to bleep it out again for YouTube.
Rhymes with itch.
Yes.
Yes.
But I won't say it. But he
or the character on Halloween riding the broom, it rhymes with.
Yes.
he went towards kids, and it was all about merchandise and cartoons, and it was over the top characters.
Yeah.
So tell me about that. How was Vince McMahon just a softie for kids, or did he see that as big business? Ken, you were there on the inside. What was your take on Vince McMahon steering the product really exclusively towards kids?
Advertising revenue. You know, you look at all the ratings. I mean, the most important rating is what, 18 to 49. And as Vince recognized the tremendous revenue source that TV could be, he realized, or, you know, was told by his television people that, hey, you know, our ratings are good, but we're skewing older and right. We need to get younger viewers. So I think the real reason is, you know, Vince has nothing against kids, don't misunderstand. But I think the real driving force behind that was advertising, television revenue, and the coveted age group is 18 to 49. Vince knew he had to start appealing to younger viewers. And I think that's also what drove Vince, you know, WrestleMania 1 to bring in Cyndi Lauper, you know, the young people that were into music. It was basically advertising revenue and, hey, we got to get younger ratings.
Yeah. Now, Bruce, I take exception to what you said, that he started gearing it toward kids. The cartoon stuff was for the kids, of course, the rock and wrestling. But the product was looked at, if you saw what the audience looked like in the early days of the WrestleManias and all that, they were Wall Street executives buying tickets for their whole staff. It became a phenomenon, I hate that word. But it became a huge event. It was something that everybody was following, not just kids. The kids had part of it with the cartoons, but the adults and the younger demographic had this exciting thing that Hulk Hogan, Roddy Piper, Paul Orndorff, Mr. T, all these guys, these were larger than life characters out there on TV. So he wasn't just putting it on for kids. He was going for that younger demographic, and it was genius to do the cartoon to get kids to want their parents to take them to see the matches because these guys were cartoon characters.
But Bill, I understand. I'm just thinking more like, does the adult wrestling fan buy into Hillbilly Jim as much as, or Coco Beware with the parrot, right? Instead of Coco Ware, the high flying wrestler from Memphis. Does the more mature fan buy into that as much as 7-year-old, 8-year-old kids?
Yes, because it turns some fans away, but for the most part, there was an excitement about that era that, like a Hillbilly Jim after the dancing and all that, he was still a wrestler there once the bell rang.
Ken, are you looking for something on YouTube?
No, on my screen it said an Adobe update is available and I can't get out of it.
But so we can see you.
We can see you.
I can't see you guys at all.
That's what happened to me before.
Well, Ken, if you can hear me, when Vince was doing the kid stuff, right, and this, I'm going back to 85, 86, you were in the AWA, was there any sense from Vern that this is never going to work? We need to market towards adults and that won't succeed.
No, the only real step he took was, you know, after Vince had, you know, was bringing in the entertainers, bringing in Cyndi Lauper, it was Wrestle Rock, you know, had already been announced for the Metrodome, and then they added Waylon Jennings. But other than that, they never really changed, you know, their style till the very end, the turkey on the pole and the challenge, because that was just, you know, desperate to see, you know, what would work, you know, kind of throw it on the wall and let's see if anything sticks. But
they all
you know, but again, you know, remember Vince was getting these, you know, huge television revenue and realized it. And Vern was still using television to drive ticket sales for the house shows. So, you know, he hadn't really caught up and never really did to what television could be. You know, television was, you know, a huge revenue stream for Vince. And to Vern, television, we need television to sell tickets.
Yeah, for that old school mentality. And keep in mind that I remember that Vern telling me, asking me one time, you think Vince is going to run out of money? And I said, I can't tell you. I haven't seen his bank account, but what he's doing is on a larger scale than a lot of stuff that I've ever seen. So it's going someplace. I don't know where.
Well, and we've talked about it. If WrestleMania 1 had not been the success it was, I think that helped him get, you know, more investors, pretty much, as you said, you know, mainstream viewers were now becoming wrestling fans.
Absolutely.
But if WrestleMania 1 had been a flop, I don't know if there would be have been a WrestleMania 2.
February 21st, 1980, Vince McMahon founded Titan Sports, and Titan Sports acquired the Capital Wrestling Corporation in 1982 from his father, and his father passed away in 1984. And those sequence of events really gave us the wrestling history.
I'm going to tell you something, though, about that, okay? I remember Vince McMahon Sr. calling me. And he said, in your magazines, we're going to change the Worldwide Wrestling Federation to the World Wrestling Federation. And I asked him, why? And he says, well, everybody knows the world is wide. So it just, seriously, that's what he said. And that's when I think it was like a different, it was becoming incorporated as WWE and WWF, and that was the story.
You know, it's interesting. I never met Vince Sr., but when his name would come up, you know, when we were on breaks or in the locker room, and again, you know, as Bill Apter rightly pointed out, he had a little, you know, territory takeover in him before Vince Jr., you know, really took it to the degree. But in terms of the talent and the boys, never heard a bad word about Vince Sr.
No, he was a very classy individual. He really was.
Can't quite say so much about Vince Jr., but Vince Sr. never heard a bad word.
Yeah. Final question, guys, and then we'll kick it to what we're going to do next week. Was there anybody inside the business that actually thought Jack Tunney was in charge of anything for the WWF?
All the fans did.
Yeah, I was one of them.
Right, I did too. When somebody was an official back then, well, there was no reason why not to believe it.
Yeah.
Would you not believe it?
Ken, did Jack Tunney sign your checks?
No, but hey, I met and actually did some interviews with Jack. But my best guess, Jack, I think probably had certainly a tie-in to, Pat Patterson and the Canadians. But I think Jack also helped Vince inroads in the Canadian cities. And
absolutely, for a fact. Frank Tunney, who was the promoter at Maple Leaf Gardens and built an empire, was very close with Vince Sr. And Jack Tunney, first of all, Jack couldn't have signed the checks because, you know, his position was an official. He wasn't in charge of the company. Gee.
No, I know that, Bill. I know that.
To put a ribbon on this, I will say this, having, you know, worked with both of them. Jack Tunney was far more presidential and had more presidential duties than did Stanley Blackburn.
Stanley Blackburn, the AWA president, every year on my birthday, October 22nd, he would call me and wish me happy birthday every year since I met him the first time in Amarillo.
Did Vern ever call you to wish you happy birthday?
No.
Well, see, there you go. That was Stanley's duty. That was his one job, to call you on your birthday.
No, but he did. Either that, or if he missed it, he'd send me a letter. by snail mail and send me a birthday card. He was a terrific guy. I really liked
nice
him.
Nice guy.
Wrestling with History, Vince McMahon. That's the show for today. We thank you for getting.
We're going to do the Stanley Blackburn Hour.
No. We got to get out of here before that happens. Thank you for getting this far. That means that we qualified as a monetized episode with Megaphone, and that's how we pay the talent here. So make sure that you listen and tell your friends to listen for more than 6 or 7 minutes.
That's I got the check. I was able to afford the Fruit Adventure Tic Tacs.
There we go.
The big box.
And we're going to tell you in the coming weeks as we rebrand VOC Nation Radio Network to VOC Nation Wrestling Network about more ways that you can help support. Obviously, you can buy the T-shirts, Killer Ken Made It Real, and a bunch of other fantastic shirts at vocnationshirts.com. That's part of the Pro Wrestling Tees family. Next week, guys, we are going to talk about three significant champions from the, I would say, the 60s and 70s, right, is a fair point. And Bill, give it to us.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Hang on. I'm just trying to find the right color Tic Tac to do this with here. The idea is, and I think people will really love this with Wrestling with History, let's take three of the great champions, one of them from the mid-60s, well, two of them, actually. Yeah. Why don't we look at the backstage, some backstage stories and the greatness of people that Ken and I both met and were around quite a bit. Harley Race, Vern Gagne, and Bruno Sammartino.
Very exciting.
Now, I can do a Bruno imitation. I can do a Harley imitation, but I don't have a Vern one. Wait, do you want to hear the two I can do, or should we wait till next week?
I think we should wait till next week. Okay. Let's leave it in suspense. I do have a story when we get there. You have to remind me of you yelling at my former co-host for doing a Bruno impression to Bruno, and that was sacrilegious to many people, including Bill After.
Was that Namar?
Namar, yeah.
I think I remember that.
We had a very popular show in Philadelphia. Namar didn't understand all of the inside rules in professional wrestling. And he was doing, we were, barking at a convention for lack of a better term. And he was doing Bruno impressions and Bruno was there and Bill was not a happy camper. We'll talk about that next week. But for this week, we're out of time. For Wonderful Willie, the legend maker.
Wait a minute. What time is it in China right now?
10 a.m. 10:21 a.m. Right, something
wow.
like that.
So wake up, China. You gotta check this out.
Wake up, China. For Bill After, Killer Ken Resnick. I'm the voice of choice, Bruce Ford. Send us out, Bill and Ken.
We'll see. I leave it up to Bill.
No, we'll see you at the matches. Eventually. Take it, killer.
I can't top that. Like Bill said, we'll see you eventually, maybe.
He's holding back on his trademark, folks.
So your trademark is that one big word, Bruce.
Maybe we'll get it next week. Worldwide in the VOC Nation Wrestling Network.
China, too.
This right here is the future of wrestling.